Okay, we're back. I just want to finish up this discussion. About the question of why did Chazal choose to write in the manner that they did, using mashal, using metaphor. Last time we looked at, again, we're using the Rambam's introduction to Perek Chelek as our main text, but I want to try to correlate that with some other pieces of his writing. Last time we looked at his introduction to the Mishnah. I just want to point out that next, we're getting ready to launch the schedule for the next Zman, the next semester of Web Yeshiva, which will start on January 10th, and I think that next semester in this slot, we're going to be learning that particular work, the Rambam's introduction to the Mishnah, which is his history of Torah Sheba'al Peh, of everything that happened from the moment that Moshe came down from the mountain up until his time, and let's say maybe even up until our own. Pardon me for one second. Okay. Again, if you have a webcam, please hit the send video button so we can see you. This is the Rambam's introduction to the Moreh Nevuchim, to the Guide to the Perplexed. I had sent this to you a while ago in a different translation. This is the translation of Shlomo Pines, P-I-N-E-S, the edition, the two-volume edition published by the Chicago University Press. The Rambam, aware of the fact that in this magnum opus, he's going to be saying a lot of different things, so he's aware of a particular pitfall. But he's also aware that this pitfall is the problem which brought the Navoch, the perplexed student. The perplexed student's name was Yosef ben Yehuda. I always recall that because that happens to be my own name. So that always has particular resonance for me because I guess like most people, I also sometimes feel a little perplexed. But the actual student that turned to the Rambam with questions to whom this work was addressed, his name was Yosef ben Yehuda. So the Rambam says, one of seven causes should account for the contradictory or contrary statements to be found in any book or compilation. In other words, sometimes you look at any work, let's say you're looking at the Chumash, you're going to find things there that are contradictory, or at least on the surface appear to be problematic or contradictory. If you're looking at a philosophical work, let's say like the Guide of the Perplexed, well, you might find things in one chapter that seem to contradict things in another chapter. Let's say you're an Amora, a rabbi of the Talmudic period, and you're looking at the Mishnah. What's a lot of what the Amoraim are doing, what's part of the agenda of the Talmud, is to say, well, this Mishnah says this, and that Mishnah says that, or this Mishnah says this, and that Brisa says that, and how can we reconcile them under a kind of notion that we're working under a grand unified principle, that we'd like to have some kind of unity, that all things being equal, we want to try to avoid machlokas. So when you have two apparently different statements, the Gemara will take a number of different... There are a number of different approaches the Gemara might take. The Gemara might try to explain that statement A is talking about case A, and statement B is talking about case B. So really, it's apples and oranges, and therefore there's no contradiction. Sometimes when your back is against the wall, the Gemara has to admit that there's a contradiction, and then all we have to do is determine what's the normative position, what's the normative halakha. But that's always a type of last resort. The Rambam lists seven causes to which we could ascribe there being contradictory opinions found within one work, which is something that we don't want. It's inelegant, it's problematic. The first cause is that the author collects the remarks of various people with differing opinions, but has omitted citing his authorities and has not attributed each remark to the one who said it. So in other words, like if we were to, imagine a historian 100 years from now is going to find the notes of, somebody that did the polling before, a recent election. But all he has is the statements of the pollies, and we don't know. And he'll come to this idea that it's all one author who was very confused, because on the first line he says he's very much in favor of Barack Obama, and on the second line he says he's very much in favor of John McCain. On the third line he'll say something derogatory about Sarah Palin, and then on the fourth line he'll say something very praiseworthy about Sarah Palin, and it'll look like it's all one big confusion. How could somebody possess all of these opinions? So then you have to rely on some kind of documentary hypothesis, pardon the expression, to explain that no, these are different opinions, the voices of separate speakers, but for whatever reason, we don't have all of that information. That's a kind of reason. We're not going to study each of these causes, but the third cause, the Rambam says, not all the statements in question are to be taken in their external sense. Some are to be taken in their external sense, while some others are parables, are mishalim, are allegorical, and hence have an inner content. Alternatively, this is kind of answer 3b, two apparently contradictory propositions may both be parables, and when taken in their external sense, may contradict or be contrary to one another. So you might have two mishalim that are really aiming at the same central idea, but on the external, they might be in contradiction. Or, in the first case, in the first part of the third cause, you have two different statements. One is giving it to you straight out, and the other is a mashal, the other is a parable, and you're trying to compare apples and oranges, as it were. You're trying to compare the mashal and the nimshal, and they might be coming at it from two different directions, and it would cause a problem. I was trying to think of an example. We talked last time about Aesop's fables. So in Aesop's fables, very often there are animals, anthropomorphized animals. So in one of them, a rabbit is very arrogant. But in another, you might imagine that a rabbit is very industrious, right, or productive. And we might say about somebody who's very prodigious that he multiplies like rabbits. So we would have two different positions about the rabbit. In one of them, the hare falls asleep out of his arrogance and he lets the turtle get the better of him. In another, we're saying that that's a guy with his nose to the grindstone. They're both aiming towards similar internal content, but we don't have parity between the mashalim. I'm sorry, Tehillah asks what's the difference between the mashal and the nimshal. The mashal is the parable. The nimshal is the truth to which the parable is aiming. It's the target of the parable. So, for example, the mashal is the sun and the moon are arguing about who would be in control. You may know this midrash from Rashi in the first parak in Bereishis. The nimshal, or the moral, as Tehillah says it, is some idea about modesty and about what happens to you when you try to take control of the situation in an arrogant way. But we pointed out that, at least in the manner in which we have it recorded in Aesop's fables, usually there's a fable about a fox and a hen and an ant and a grasshopper and a rabbit and a hare. And then, at least in the written editions that we have, which are pretty ancient, they're not as ancient as the oral tradition of those tales, but usually there's a moral. Like at the end, it spells it out for you. In other words, it puts a pretty sharp point on it. It tells you, this is the moral of the story. So it spells out the nimshal. And I pointed out that Chazal very often don't do that. They just leave it as the mashal. And we were wondering why it might be that Chazal do this. The Rambam then says, in the seventh cause, the seventh reason that things might seem a little unclear when you read a work, is in speaking about very obscure matters, it is necessary to conceal some parts and to disclose others. And this is the notion that he mentioned in the Hakdama, the Perush HaMishnayot, that sometimes we don't want to spell it out because there are certain notions that people have to work towards. And we don't want to spell it out. We don't want to have, the Rambam didn't think that we should have. I was in a bookstore the other day, and I saw one of those books, An Idiot's Guide to Kabbalah, or, the Torah Shebaal Peh, the Talmud for Dummies, or these kinds of series of books. And there are such books. Maybe they're even good books. I don't know. Maybe I'm a snob. I always thought that, it seemed to me when those books came out, that series, the Four Dummies books or the Idiot's Guide to Fill in the Blank books, I thought, who's going to buy those books? Who's going to go into a store and stand online and admit to the cashier that they're an idiot or they're a dummy? But it seems to me that those books are very popular, so I guess it's not an impediment to sales. The Rambam is of the opinion that there are certain things that, we can't popularize. Somebody just privately admitted to me that they have a shelf full of these idiot dummy books, and that he finds them interesting depending upon the author. But they chatted this to me privately, not wanting to admit it to everyone, so perhaps I was right. So the Rambam is the idea that there's certain ideas that can't be popularized, and that people have to work towards them. A drop further on, the Rambam says, some passages in every prophetic book, this is on page 19 of the first volume of the Shlomo Pinas edition of the Mor Nebuchim. Some passages in every prophetic book, when taken in their external sense, appear to contradict or to be contrary to one another. And this is due to the third cause, the thing that we saw initially, and to the fourth. And it was with this in view that this entire introduction was written. And perhaps even it's towards this purpose that the Rambam sets out to write the entirety of the Mor Nebuchim, to resolve and to explain how language works and how the wisdom of the Torah is encapsulated in such statements. Then he goes on to say, however, most of the prophetic statements they refer to concern commandments or precepts regarding conduct. So when it comes to the normative part of the Torah, the part of the Torah that's telling you what to do and how to act and what a mitzvah is and how what tefillin look like and what a sukkah is, etc. We, on the other hand, however, propose to draw attention to verses that are apparently contradictory with regard to opinions and beliefs. And this is really the crux of the problem. This is really the crux of the problem for the Rambam, that when it comes to, you know, the normative components, what we call halakha with a capital H, dinim, laws, ritual. So, you know, maybe the Torah Shebichtav is unclear here and there, which is why you need a Torah Shebaalpeh, which is why you need a Torah Shebaalpeh. Again, this will be one of the larger topics we'll deal with next semester. But what about the other component of religious life, the realm of opinions, of beliefs, of emunot v'deot, of personality traits, of sensing what is the right and the good, what is proper behavior, what are proper ways to conduct one's mental life. So that too, we have to look at Chazal, and we have to resolve apparent contradictions. And that is the work. That is the work of the great medieval philosophical, Jewish philosophical enterprise. I want to go back for a second to this point that sometimes you could have two mishalim that cause confusion. They might be aiming at the same point, or they might be aiming at the same moral or the same message, but, you know, like Marshall McLuhan taught us, the message is the medium. Strike that, reverse it. The medium is the message. That how you package an idea affects the nature of the content of that idea. I assume this is a term and a concept that's familiar to everyone. If not, please let me know. This notion of the medium is the message. What's the most famous example of this idea of the medium is the message? Anyone know? Yeah, very good, Tilo Leah. The Nixon-Kennedy debates. People that watched it on TV had a different response than people that listened to it on the radio. People that watched it on TV, influenced by Kennedy's charm and good looks, gave him higher marks. Nixon, the opposite. This is an example of the medium being the message. So the same thing is true for Mashal. If I'm trying to say something about modesty, if I'm trying to say something about modesty, and I package that notion in a parable about the sun and the moon having a fight, that's liable to impact upon the message. It's on this most simplest plane, it's liable to distract us if the listener can't get to the deeper level. And if they're going to think, like the Rambam described, the three ways of interpreting Agadah, if they're going to think that the metaphor is the message itself. Yeah, very, very good point, Jim. I'll give you another example from real life. When a year ago, when Obama was elected, I thought that the inauguration was going to be a historic event. In all cases, I mean, forget whatever your opinion of his performance over this past year. The election of the first African American president is a matter of some historical significance. So we don't have a television, but we went to somebody else's house to watch the inauguration. And my kids, at least my middle child, who at the time was 7 years old, didn't understand why we were going to listen to somebody give a long speech. I said, no, but it's historic. You'll want to be able to say that you saw it. You know, when you're older, you'll say that you saw it. I said, it'll be like, you know, watching the men land on the moon. So that's a kind of mashal. I was trying to build this idea that X is similar to Y. It's not a metaphor. It's what we call a simile. Right? I was trying to draw an association. that it's a. I was the metaphor the moral or the content that I'm trying to get at was this is an event of great significance, one about which people will be talking for many years, and you'll want to have said that you saw it. So we go and we watch this thing, and you know she was a little agitated by the whole by watching this long speech about something she didn't understand. And when it was over, she said to me, "I don't get it. Where were the astronauts?" So you see how the medium is the message, right? My metaphor was lost on her. My simile was lost on her. Here are just a couple of examples of what might appear to somebody as a potential contradiction in the Torah. There's a pasuk in Shirat Hayam, Hashem Ish Milchama, Hashem Shmo, God is a man of war. But then there's a pasuk that says, Lo ish kel, v'chazev v'nadam, etc. That God is not a man. So, in other words, one of these is a metaphor, the other is a statement. The other is a statement. And they seem to contradict, because the pshat of both of them can't be reconciled. And you have to understand... You have to understand that the first pasuk, the pasuk from Shirat Hayam, that Hashem is an ish milchama, is a man of war, is trying to say something about God and about what's happening in Mitzrayim. But it doesn't mean that God is a man, even though that's what the pasuk says. But it's a way of communicating an idea that God is a warrior. Right? He's not a warrior. What's a warrior? A warrior is somebody that's very big and strong, and he carries weapons, and he has a shield, and he has a sword, and he has a helmet, and he has who knows what else. Right? God is not like that in any way. So what is he? He's something else. What is that something else? I don't know. But to say that he's an ish milchama in the context of Yetziat Mitzrayim, in the context of Kriyat Yam Suf, is a metaphor. It's a mashal. But you can't resolve the pshat of the mashal with the otherwise normative fact that God is not a man. And, you know, man is not a God. Similarly, we have these two psukim. One says, kind of lays it out straight, Lo tuchal lirot et panai, right? That Hashem tells Moshe, Kilo yirani adam b'chai, a person cannot see me and live. That a person cannot see me. Why can't a person see me and live? So this is a topic, again, that the philosophers have spilt much ink on. But perhaps the simplest way to understand it is that a person can't see Hashem and not... It's not that you can't see Hashem and live. Meaning, if you were to see Hashem, then you would die, like as some kind of consequence of having seen Hashem. But you can't be chai, you can't be alive and see Hashem, because it's impossible. Well, again, to say that Hashem has a face, Tehillaleya asks, there's no real contradiction in the second set, because the second phrase does not say that Moshe saw Hashem's face, just that he saw him. But again, what does it say to, in other words, by definition, to say that a person, when Hashem says, you can't see my face, well, Hashem doesn't have a face, just like he doesn't have a hand, just like he doesn't have a finger, just like he doesn't have a leg or a foot, right? So the whole thing is in the context of a metaphor. But whatever it is, it's saying, me, God, no seeing. You can't see me. If you're alive, if you're a human being, by definition, part of the human condition, or part of the condition of having been created and being in this world is you can't see me. The second one says that Hashem, that Moshe did see Hashem in some way or form, or he sees the image of God, but he sees something, and Tehillaleh is correct. These are both metaphors. These are the two cases that the Rambam outlines in the third clause. One is two conflicting metaphors, or two metaphors that are in that are in tension, because if you look at the pshat, they're going to lead you into some kind of confusion. You're going to think, X says this and Y says that. What am I going to do? I'm stuck. So you have to understand there are two metaphors, and they're both aiming towards a deeper truth. The first set of examples is a pasuk. Is a pasuk. Lo ish el. That man, God is not a man. That's not a metaphor. That's telling it to you straight. And then the idea that Hashem is ish milchama, that's a metaphor. So this is the case of what the Rambam, says in the third clause. Not all the statements in question are to be taken in their external sense. Some are to be taken in the external sense, while some others are parables, and hence have inner content. That's this case here. In the first case, one is meant to be taken literally, and the other is meant to be taken metaphorically, which is why it causes a problem. The other, the second part of the third clause, is two metaphors that on the surface seem to be in contradiction, but are aiming both at deeper truths. Alright, so what does that mean? So Chaim asks the question, what does his medrash mean when it says that you can see behind Hashem to see his tefillin not? So that's obviously not meant to be taken literally. What does it mean? I don't know, but it might be related to the midrash we talked about last week about what does it mean that God wears tefillin. God doesn't have a tefillin knot because he doesn't have a head to hold the tefillin knot up with. So whatever that means, it certainly needs to be interpreted metaphorically for some type of deeper wisdom. Just to demonstrate that this doesn't, we don't have to limit ourselves. We don't have to limit ourselves to psukim, neither to Midrashei Chazal. But let's look at something post-Talmudic. The very first sentence in the Shulchan Aruch. The very first sentence in the Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch starts off with a metaphor, or at least a simile. Yitgaber ka'ari lamod baboker la'avot boro. A person, a Jew, this is again the very first sif, and the very first simin, and the very first chelek of the Shulchan Aruch. A person should yitgaber, should overcome, should strive, should struggle, gvura, should act with might and with courage to jump up in the morning to the service of his maker, the service of the creator, shehu me'orer ha'shachar. Right? Don't get caught lounging in bed, but you should jump out of bed with alacrity like a lion. Yitgaber ki'ari. So first of all, it's just interesting that the very first word in the Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch is this great code of law that kind of lays out for us in detail the halacha l'maaseh, how you have to live your life, right? So if you're somebody that's interested in doing mitzvot, so then you have to be a Shulchan Aruch Jew. You have to say that I'm going to do it like the Shulchan Aruch and the commentaries that define what the Shulchan Aruch means. But essentially, we are the Jews of the Shulchan Aruch. So, it's interesting that the very first word, the very first directive of the Shulchan Aruch is Yitgaber. That's kind of the state of being Jewish, is you have to get over it. You have to strive on, you have to plow on, you have to have a little gvura, a little fortitude. That's the nature of being Jewish. This was true. This was true in the 16th century when the Mechaber was read in the Shulchan Aruch. It's true today also, although we might have something of an easier time of it. So the very first directive in the Shulchan Aruch is a metaphor, Yitgaber. How should you go about showing your alacrity? You should do it like a lion. So when the Shulchan Aruch makes this metaphor of Yitgaber Ke'ari, what do we think he means? Right? So he probably means something like this. like the picture of ferocity, of energy, of verve, of, I mean, there's a reason that that the lion is the king of the beasts. I mean, just the majesty and the power of that picture. You know, that's Yitgaber Ka'ari. He should jump out of bed to do mitzvot in the morning, to do avodat borei olam, to serve the master of the world with the same kind of energy that you see when you think of a lion like this, a ferocity to do mitzvot. But what's the problem? A few years ago, right, so Tehila Leah points out that lions are actually kind of lazy. A couple of years ago, Rabbi Bravender was a scholar in residence down in South Africa, I think for Shavuos. Some former students invited him down. He went down to teach. But while he was in South Africa, they took him on one of these safaris. And in order to do a safari, you know, one of these big game parks, you get up before the crack of dawn. You get up, you know, like a couple of hours before the crack of dawn, because that's when everything is happening. And what does it mean? Yitgaber ka'ari lamod baboker. Lions don't actually get up in the morning. This is what a lion looks like in the morning. It looks like a lazy house cat. And you could probably like go up to this guy and tickle him on the tummy. So what in the world is the Shulchan Aruch talking about when it says Yitgaber Ka'ari? Lions don't mitgaber baboker. The whole metaphor isn't working. You know, lions, they hunt at night, then they fill their stomachs until they're like bloated, and then they sleep it off. They don't get up to do anything in the morning. So you could say, again, please don't think that I'm like making too much of this. But what's the Shulchan Aruch doing? So it's making a metaphor. And all metaphors, by definition, are dangerous. Because you're trying to describe something in a different way than it is. Serving Hashem is not like being a lion. Right? In any way, shape, or form. Except for the fact that lions somehow, as like this visual symbol, when you first saw this first picture, you know, there was a certain association. A certain association of what Avodas Hashem might be like if it's inspired by whatever the values of this picture are. And it doesn't matter that in reality it looks a little more like this, which does not seem to be the picture of a serious Oved Hashem, a serious worshipper of God. But that doesn't matter, because you have to understand how to read it as a metaphor. So the Meforshim, well, I don't pretend that the Meforshim are trying to make the point that I'm making, but the Meforshim, like for example, the Taz, the Turei Zahav, the great commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, points out that Yitgaber Ka'ari, Ikar Gvura, the essential part of strength, the kind of fortitude that we need in order to serve God, is against the Yetzer Hara, is against the evil inclination. Shenemar, or Shamru, Ezehu Gibur, the Mishan Avot asks, who is a strong person? Again, Yitgaber and Gvura and Gibur, these are all the same words. Strength, fortitude, courage. Who is a strong person? Hakovesh et Yitzro, the person that can conquer his own will, a person that can control himself, that can execute a certain amount of self-control. V'amar ki ari, and it's compared to an ari, to a lion, ki teva ha'ari asher ein lo yirah mishum biriyah, because the lion is fearless, at least in the state of nature. There's no, in the food chain, the lion is on top. And the lion doesn't think that there's anybody out there that can stop him. It's just a question if they can get away from the lion. I mean, you've all seen the National Geographic. Right? You know that sooner or later, the lion always captures the antelope. Even though there's always another antelope that gets away to be eaten another day. Or to have other antelopes which will be eaten another day. That's what... So the Taz, again, not trying to do this literary thinking out loud, but the Taz kind of unpacks the metaphor. In what way should you be like an Ari? In the way that you have to think that you can do it. That you can do it. That in the fight against the Yetzer Hara, you're the lion, the Yetzer Hara is the antelope. And, you know, at the end of the day, the lion is going to eat the antelope. It's always that way. You can watch that nature channel all day long, and it always ends with a lion chewing on the zebra or on the antelope. So again, you see, what does it mean to use a metaphor? It's a metaphor which is imprecise in the sense that lions don't jump up in the morning. They lounge around. But that's unimportant because it's striking at a different point. But there's always the danger that the simpleton will read the Shulchan Aruch, or will read the Psukim, or will read the Divrei Chazal, and miss the point. You'll get caught up on the, you know, like the child that gets more excited about the box the present comes in than the present itself. You miss the... You have to keep your eye on the prize. Let me just pause for a second and read some of these comments that are coming in. Okay. The person that privately referenced a Bugs Bunny cartoon gets an extra point for, popular culture reference. And Tehila Leia points out that she has a cat that sometimes makes appearances on the webcam. So, okay. But that cat probably likes to lounge out and sleep a lot. Cats, I think, sleep like 20 hours a day or something like that. So this is kind of wrapping up the discussion about Mashal. Let's move on to really what's the main topic and the thing that got you all to sign up for the Shi'ur, because you're interested in the world to come. Now again, it's been a bit of a meandering path to get to the discussion about Olam Haba, because the Rambam first had to explain to you how do we understand the sources from which we can mine in understanding of what Olam Haba about, for what Olam Haba is about. Here in the fourth section of the Hakdama Perek Chelek, the Rambam starts off by saying, "Vata achela daber b'masheretziti." And now I'll start talking about what I wanted to talk about, which is this question of Olam Haba. Again, remember the Mishnah said, "Kol Yisrael yesh lem chelek leolam haba." All of Israel has a share in the world to come, except for those that don't. But the Mishnah does not explicate for us what Olam Haba is, and the Rambam feels it necessary to explain that. Da, you should know. Ki kemo shelo yasig hasuma hatzvaim. Very, very, very well-known, often quoted passage in the Rambam. Just like a blind person, I assume we're talking about a congenitally blind person, a person blind from birth. Just like a blind person cannot fathom the spectrum of colors, v'lo yasiga cheresh hakolot, and somebody deaf from birth cannot fathom what sound is like. I mean, maybe they can think about it in an abstract way, but it'll never be more than an abstraction because they can't experience it themselves. And a eunuch can't have certain passions, let's say. You get the point. Kain lo yasigu hagufot ta'anugim hanafshiim. So similarly, gufot, bodies. What's a body? A body is you and me. A created mortal creature. A human being is a guf, is a body. We're a paradox. We're a spiritual being housed in a physical reality. And, it's this notion of the tachtonim and the elyonim, of the upper and the lower, of being part angel and part animal, and those two components of ourselves struggling against each other. But since that is the nature of who we are, since we are by definition physical, we can't understand what pure nefesh is, what the completely non-physical spiritual life is. What the Rambam calls ta'anugim nafshiim. Ta'anugim are pleasures. Now, again, we immediately fall into the language trap. Ta'anugim, pleasures, oneg Shabbos, that's a word that means physical things. Oneg Shabbos means a good piece of herring and a shot of whiskey at the Kiddush. Oneg Shabbos means a good long nap. A piece of kugel. So the very word itself is trapped into our associations of what pleasure is, because we associate pleasure with things that are connected to our physical reality. So the Rambam says we can't understand what spiritual pleasures are. And maybe he even chose this word to highlight the dilemma. Because the whole concept of pleasure is so rooted in the physical world that to think about it in the non-corporeal sense is as impossible as shelo yeda hadag yisod ha'esh. Just like a fish can't imagine fire, the element of fire. It's just so completely foreign to him. Just like a fish can't imagine life outside of the water. I mean, all of these types of metaphors, where we imagine not the anthropomorphization of animals, like an Aesop, the tortoise, the hare, the rabbit, the grasshopper, but where we imagine the human beings becoming like animals, in fairy tales where the person is turned, like the prince is turned into a frog. Or when you were a kid, you might have imagined, I have a kid who's like 2.5 years old, and he like runs around the house making all of the noises in the barnyard. And at one minute he's a chicken, and at the next minute he's a cow, and the next minute he's a horse, who knows what, they just make these noises. And he thinks, like he pretends he's a kangaroo when he's jumping around. So in reality, you can't imagine what it means to be a fish, because that very process of imagining what it's like to be a fish involves a level of awareness, of self-awareness and reflection, which is by definition unfish-like. In other words, like in all those stories, what's that story about the guy that turns into become a donkey? There's a William Steig book like that, we have it in our kids' bookshelf, where donkey turns into a rock. And anybody know what's the story? Stonecutter? No. Anyway, I forget the name of this book. But, the prince is turned into a frog, and in all the stories, and then he wants to be a prince again. So, by definition, he's not a frog. Because a frog can't even imagine what it's like to be a prince. So this idea that you could become the frog who wants to be the prince again, through the kiss of the beautiful princess, is a component of life which is so unfrog-like that you don't know what it's like to be a frog. In order to be a frog, you'd have to, like, not be able to even think of, well, what it would be like to be a prince. And then you'd be stuck because you'd never get out of being a frog. So you'd never come back to our side and know what it would have been like. So it's not just that the fish can't imagine what life on dry land is like. We can't even imagine what it's like to be a fish. Because the process of trying to imagine what it's like being a fish is, by definition, unfish-like. Because fish don't think in that way. So the Rambam says, imagining what Olam Haba is like all of these things. It's ultimately impossible. At best, you can just, you know, kind of like get your mind around the contours of an issue, but you can never really know. Kein lo ibadu bazeh ha'olam hagufani tanugei olam haruchani. In this world, in the physical world, we can never really fully grasp what life in the purely spiritual realm is like. Ela ein etzlenu b'shum panim tanug zulati tanug hagufo bilvad. Because our pleasures are all rooted in the physical, in a component of the fact that we are physical beings. V'hasagat hachushim min ha'machal v'ha'mishteh v'ha'tashmish u'mashu chutz mizeh harehu etzlenu bilti nimtza. V'lo nakirehu v'lo nasigehu b'tchilat ha'machshava ela achar chakira rabah. Since, by definition, we are physical beings, lefichach lo nasig ela ta'anugo. Aval hata'anugim hanafshiim harehem matmidim, bilti nifsakim. Ve'en b'nehem uvein elu ha'ta'anugim yachas b'shum panim. So the Rambam is saying is that by definition, even the notion of pleasure, the idea that, well, pleasure here is rooted in physical things, but pleasure there is something else altogether, means that the exercise of thinking about what will be our pleasures, what will be our rewards, what will be the benefits in the next world, is again a case of comparing apples and oranges. We're using the same language, ta'anug, pleasures here, pleasures there, but they have no connection to each other. The definition of pleasure here, you know, you go to two people go out to eat, or two people eat dinner. One person goes out to a very fancy restaurant and has the nicest of things with the best of service, of steak dinner, caviar for an appetizer, a delicious cake, rich cake for dessert, whatever it is, imagine whatever it is that you like, served on fine china. Another person has a cup of soup and a peanut butter sandwich, eaten, you know, off a stack tray in front of the TV, wearing pajamas. Either way, both of them have to wake up in the morning and have breakfast. So that pleasures in this world are fleeting. If you have a really great nap on Shabbat, this Shabbat, next Shabbat, that doesn't help you. You'll need another one. Pleasures by definition, physical pleasures by definition, are fleeting. But the Rambam says, first off, pleasures in the world to come are not like that. They're tmidiim. Bilti nifsakim. Right? It's on all the time. It's again, I'll use a metaphor which will be inexact. It'll be like the pleasure of eating that meal, but always. But again, that's so inexact that it doesn't help us. Because the thought of that beautiful, delicious meal I was describing, the idea that it would go on forever becomes unappetizing. All physical pleasures, by definition, wax and wane. And if they were constant, they would cease being pleasurable. like Midas's touch, the pleasure of being able to turn things to gold, is diminished when everything you touch turns to gold. Ve'ein nachon etzleinu b'Torah, ve'lo etzel Elohim min ha'filosofim lomar, ki hamlacha ve'hakocham. We'll skip that part. Right? It could also be that, just to try to connect the dots, another reason for obscuring the deeper meaning of all of these types of things, by obscuring them in Mashal, is that, by definition, we can only ever partially get it. So that Mashal is the only way that we can begin to wrap our heads around the nature of what it is that we're talking about, because we don't fully know what it is that we're talking about. Take, for example, think to yourselves, take some really abstract concept, love. Take love, for example. So try defining love in such a way that, imagine a creature lands from outer space, and imagine Mr. Spock shows up, a creature with no emotions whatsoever, doesn't possess emotions, doesn't feel emotions, or at least has suppressed them to such a degree that they don't feel emotions. Imagine a creature in a parallel universe that doesn't possess any emotions whatsoever, and doesn't feel emotions, doesn't know emotions, and emotions are as foreign to them as living on dry land is to fish, or as colors are to a blind person. Okay, Tehillaleya is correcting me. Trust me when I tell you that I have very, very, very broad mumchiut expertise in Star Trek, and it's true that Spock has emotions, he just suppresses them, but it would be more like Data, but I prefer the old Star Trek, but we'll leave it at that. But imagine this creature with no emotions, for whom emotions, just are like the air to the fish or colors to the blind person. How do you define love to this person? Think about it for a moment. If anybody can come up with a definition that can explain it, which doesn't become self-referential, meaning defining a thing by itself, which gets you into that little loop, which isn't useful to somebody who doesn't speak your language or share your experience. Right? Like when you were told in school you can never define a word with the word itself. So how do you do it? You can only refer to Mashal. You can only rely on building some type of Mashal, which will partially explain something, but not even fully. There's even the neurologists who tell you that you can stick somebody in an MRI and show them a picture of their grandchild who they love, and I can show you on the graph what happens. And if he points to that and says, well, that's love, so we know that that's not. It might be representing something which is true, but that's not a definition of love which is in any way useful to us. Alright, so these are definitions that are... Tehillaleya put up a definition. It's at best very, very, very partial. Very partial. So again, this is part of the problem. Okay, look, we'll skip ahead next time. Next week is Chanukah, so we won't have a shiur next Tuesday. The following week is our last shiur in this series, and hopefully we'll get to at least some of what the Rambam has to say, although surely not everything. And we'll continue in 2 weeks. In 2 weeks from now. Laila Tov. Chanukah Sameach.